podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Home Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Homelessness in LA County increased 12% over the last year, despite voters approving the Measure H quarter cent sales tax more than 2 years ago. And all that has a lot of people wondering, where did all the money go? We'll take a tour of a place that a county supervisor says is putting that revenue to good use, helping get folks off the street. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here.
Podcasts supported by Spectrum News One. Host Alex Cohen provides a deeper look at the issues affecting Southern Californians and their communities on Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for giving us a little of your attention for the next hour or so. Coming up later in today's show, we'll hear how the legendary Formosa Cafe is being renovated. That's coming up in about 45 minutes. First, though, homelessness. Now, it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that we are at crisis level here in Southern California. The problem came into focus earlier this month when the results of the annual homeless census came out, and the numbers were up again. In LA County, the homeless population increased by 12% over last year to almost 59,000 people. But for many Angelenos, the evidence is right there on the sidewalks, under freeway overpasses, and in the alleys of their own neighborhoods, makeshift tent cities and individual people just sleeping there on the street. Just last week, LA City Mayor Eric Garcetti had this to say.
We must treat this problem like the humanitarian emergency that it is. And that starts with me. As your mayor, I take full responsibility for our response to the crisis.
But it'd be a mistake to make him a scapegoat and to believe that he alone is responsible. This problem crosses borders, and many lawmakers govern Southern California at different levels. Today, we go in depth with one of them, LA County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas. He's become one of the most outspoken people on this issue. We met up with him last week, and he said that when it comes to providing the services that can help people out of homelessness, a lot of that is on his shoulders.
Well, the county of Los Angeles is basically the backbone of social services. It is essentially the safety net.
So when people out there are wondering, okay, who do we look to make this problem not be as bad as it is, you'd be the one to raise your hand on that.
I have a responsibility to do so. The Board of Supervisors does. And from that, we will not retreat.
LA County is responsible for managing the funds raised through Measure H. That's the ballot initiative voters approved in 2016. In it, the people of LA agreed to increase the sales tax and use the funds to pay for homeless services. Now, since the number of homeless people is increasing, it may not seem like those services are doing anything for anybody. And Ridley Thomas says the economy is making the situation worse. Things like rent are becoming too unaffordable too fast. But he says those funds are being put to good use. And he wanted to show us how the county is using your money to address things as fast as it can. We traveled to South LA to an organization known as HOPIX. That stands for Homeless Outreach Program Integrated Care System. It began in 1988 to provide an array of services and has since grown into four locations. With a cash infusion from Measure H, it's been able to expand even more in recent years. Here's the director of HOPIX, Veronica Lewis.
The amount of staff we have to actually triage and meet the needs of the people walking through our doors in crisis has exponentially grown in the last 2 years, from 80 to 240. Millions of rental assistance dollars has allowed us to obviously move more people off of the streets back into permanent housing. Also, on any given night, more than 2,000 individuals, when their head hits the pillow at night, they're hitting the pillow instead of the sidewalk because Measure H has allowed us to interim house that number of people every single night. Also, it's allowed us to bring in more co-located partners. And so not only are we providing more services here, but we also have a significant array of services from outside partners that are here full-time or part-time, including LAUSD providing support to families who are homeless, mental health specialists providing support to children, substance use disorder specialists providing support to families or individuals who need that help.
Veronica Lewis and Mark Ridley Thomas both gave us a tour of one Hoppex facility just off Slauson Avenue. There, we met up with a street outreach team. That's a program where a team of experts patrol the streets, then meet with homeless people and try to convince them to come to Hoppex for help. Ridley Thomas says it's grown because of money from Measure H.
When we began the outreach work on Skid Row, there were four teams. We now have 40 teams.
One team member is Jonathan Bryan, and he explained that a lot of his work is all about building trust.
There's a lot of people on the street right now that have been neglected and been hurt by people in their own family. And also, a lot of services in the past have probably led people to not understanding how many services are really available. So just by introducing ourselves and treating the person one by one, I think that helps pretty much with the relationship with the client.
There might be people out there who think that with Measure H that everyone would know about it, but how much are people maybe still not trusting that these things like Measure H are here to help them?
I think especially with the people who the services are for, they're not looking at TV, they're not looking at commercials, and probably not even knowing that the society in the city is behind them as much as we are. So again, like we come out there with the advertisement and the explanations. Sometimes we actually have to go with clients to services and kind of show a person.
So I think what Jonathan is making clear is the following. They are trust builders. For example, Hoppex has been involved in one such project, 127th and Broadway. They went into that encampment, and now approximately 100 of those individuals have permanent supportive housing. That's what street outreach work happens to be about.
We walk to another area of Hoppex where people get help in applying for benefits programs. They might need help getting a Section 8 housing voucher or receiving veterans benefits. Mark Ridley Thomas introduced us to one man who was there to get assistance, Fortuna Alvarez, who is blind.
The benefits I wanted simply to have my Section 8 housing, just the benefits granted to any legal citizen.
How has this office helped you?
Well, it's helped me out a lot. I'm thankful that it's given me a roof over my head. I'll never forget how they helped me transition from my hospital stay to my housing. I'm so grateful for that.
And if this office wasn't here, where would you be?
I think that I'd be on the street.
Muchísimas gracias por hablar con nosotros.
Gracias.
Supervisor, if people need help navigating this system, doesn't that mean that the systems maybe are too complicated and should be simplified a lot more?
Well, this is simply not simple. Homelessness is very, very complicated. This is one illustration of an individual, a human being that needed help, and this organization funded by Measure H made it happen.
For our final stop, Mark Ridley Thomas took us to the waiting room where families can get help from Hoppex, and it's separate from where single adults can go for help.
Well, this is where it gets real. These are real people who are seeking services here in the Family Solution Center, that is the point of entry here at Hoppex. All of these are families. They are homeless persons. You see children, you see seniors, you see individuals who are trying to come up.
But why is it necessary that people with families have a separate intake from other clients?
Some of the challenges that the other populations have in terms of substance abuse issues or mental health issues are not necessarily the same problems that families have, and we have to protect children.
Now, Supervisor, despite what you've been showing us, the problem of homelessness in LA has gotten worse. What do you say to Angelinos who would say that service centers like this are just not doing enough or might not be helping at all?
Think about what it would be or what it would look like without them. It would be worse. 2,000 individuals alone have been caused to have permanent supportive housing and more because of this organization's work over the life of Measure H. And you multiply that all over the county of Los Angeles. This is working, but the challenges that we're up against have been more daunting than might have been anticipated owing to economic factors. And so what we have to do is double down.
If in the next count we don't see the numbers get better, do you take responsibility?
I think we look at ourselves collectively and resolve that we have to do more. Because if we don't do what we are doing, and if we don't do it better, if we don't take this seriously, this manifestation of moral indignation will get worse.
LA County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas and Veronica Lewis, Director of HOPIX, thank you very much for having us out here and showing us around.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Staying with the subject of homelessness, we've all seen them on the streets and under freeways, homeless encampments and piles of trash that can build up around them. Some homeless people have been demanding that the city take steps to make their street camps more livable and permanent. This very idea is at the heart of a new plan that Mayor Eric Garcetti is endorsing today. Here's more from KPCC's Sharon McNary.
Walking on Alvarado Boulevard under the 101 freeway in Echo Park, you pass about 40 tents that line the broad sidewalks. Noise from the constant traffic bounces off the overpass walls. It's surprisingly neat and clean through here. No trash on the sidewalk until you get to a slope just beyond the overpass.
What we're seeing here is a pretty big pile of discards. I see some takeout containers, there's some open plates of food, blankets and pads.
This is the sort of disease-causing garbage pile that people point to when they complain about homeless encampments. I thought I'd see more trash, given that the city estimates one-fifth of the street trash comes from homeless tent cities like this one. I ran across Tommy Navarrete, formerly homeless himself, and now a paid attendant who staffs the portable restrooms provided under a city pilot program.
I need to grab some more towels.
He's scrubbing one of the toilets.
We want to keep it nice and fresh and clean for anybody that comes in.
He says underpass residents try to be organized about where they put their trash.
They'll bag it up or they'll come ask for bags. Others just dump on that corner over there or come and dump right here.
His hygiene station provides a trash can that gets dumped daily, but it's too small for the volume of trash generated here. So the trash accumulates, and at this site next to the freeway, it's up to landowner Caltrans to clear it away.
It doesn't happen on a regular basis. We're grateful that they did come and pick it up because I don't want to work in a heap of trash around me. It's toxic.
That's not to say the city doesn't do cleanups. When it does, it's usually in response to complaint calls to the city's 311 line. And it doesn't just clean up the trash, it clears away the entire encampment. Residents generally get a day or two notice to pack up and move, but they might not get any notice at all. And that's disruptive. Michael Carbajal has lived at the underpass for 7 years. He says a sweep means he and his neighbors can lose what little they have, including medications, documents, blankets, and other essentials.
We already ain't got nothing. But they come and they like clear us out and then we lose more. And it's like what that does to a person's mental stability isn't cool.
Which is why he and others want regular garbage pickups at encampments like this one. A homeless advocacy group called Services Not Sweeps is making that demand of the city.
We just need dumpsters here, not no trash cans, dumpsters.
At least one member of the city council agrees with him.
I'm in favor of trash cans and advance notice pickups.
That's West LA Councilman Mike Bonin. He complains the city spends $30 to $40 million a year on cleanups that don't improve public health or reduce homelessness.
That is a phenomenally large amount of money to be spending for a program that absolutely nobody is satisfied with.
He says sanitation workers and police dislike the confrontations that occur during sweeps, and because encampments often return soon after a sweep, residents and businesses who complained are also unhappy. But making encampments more livable also makes them more permanent. And Bonin says there's no avoiding that, so get over it.
For me, it's a matter of practicality. Do we have people leaving trash on the streets with a periodic cleanup, or do we have trash receptacles with regular pickup?
On Friday, the city's Sanitation Bureau issued a new plan, one the mayor endorses. It would provide trash containers and regular pickups at the most crowded encampments, also restrooms, hand washing stations, and even jobs staffing them. Providing all these services means the city is normalizing the presence of these tent dwellers in our public spaces, and that's going to be controversial. Covering infrastructure, I'm Sharon McNary.
All right, we just heard about LA Mayor Eric Garcetti's plan to clean up homeless camps and make them more livable. Up next, we'll get more on the Department of Sanitation's overhaul of encampment cleanups and if it signals a change in attitude when it comes to the fight against homelessness. That's coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. A few moments ago, we heard our infrastructure reporter, Sharon McNary, reporting from a homeless encampment in Echo Park. And as Sharon mentioned in her story, the Department of Sanitation recently announced a plan to overhaul encampment cleanups. And Mayor Garcetti is holding a press conference right now to talk about it. Sharon McNary joins us now in studio to tell us more. Hello, Sharon.
Hey there.
All right, this plan first became public last Friday. We debated at the Energy, Climate Change, and Environmental Justice Committee yesterday. What's in the plan?
This plan represents a real change in direction in the city's treatment of these homeless encampments. It represents a shift from sweeps, which can be disruptive and punitive and aimed at eliminating the encampment, to one that's more cognizant. There's no other place for a lot of these people to go. As you know, court decisions say that if there's no place for people to go, they have the right to exist in the public right-of-way. And while the city council has made some laws that limits how much stuff you can have in that public right-of-way, it's been proven very difficult to enforce. So this new approach focuses more on the livability at homeless encampments. Garbage cans, regular pickups, restrooms, hand washing stations, more people from the city to try and connect unhoused people with public health and other services, maybe even something as basic as toilet paper and trash bags. Also links to job training, mental health services, training to make LA City sanitation workers more sensitive to the homeless population. So we're really talking about adding 50 more employees to the 212 people already in the city's upcoming budget who deal with encampments. And some of those people are grouped in so-called livability teams that would try to improve the health and cleanliness of these encampments. And in doing so, the goal is to reestablish the trust between unhoused individuals and the city officials who are trying to get them to move into permanent housing and city services and possibly new housing that's being developed.
Yeah. Now, okay, resources. What resources will be required to get this plan going?
Money.
Yeah.
It looks like this plan calls for spending between $7.5 to $8.6 million for all these extra people and services. A lot of that is for overtime hours. People who are on staff now might be working 10 to 18 hours a week additional overtime as they try and hire up people. And it promises to deliver like this public health infrastructure at scale. So just a lot of services at a lot of places. Now, is it feasible? This is the City Sanitation Bureau's plan. The mayor's endorsing it at that news conference, but it's really the city council that has to vote to spend the money. And it's not clear they're willing to do that yet, especially given that it would tend to make these encampments more permanent than they are right now. So there are constituents like businesses and neighborhood councils might have some objections to that.
Now, you've been reporting on this a lot, Sharon. What are you hearing from people living in communities with homeless encampments?
Well, from the people in the communities, they're the ones who are calling 311 to get the city to come out and clear them away.
Yeah.
And of course, they always just come right on back.
Yeah.
The sweeps have been very disruptive to the people living in these encampments. And I think they are the ones making the call for, you know, give me some trash bags, give me a toilet, give me, something to make my life in this tent city a little bit more livable.
Now, people who live near homeless encampments, how do you think they'll respond to this proposal?
I think you're going to see a divided response. There has been a movement across the city of people standing up saying, I'll help resolve the housing crisis,
yeah.
I'll rent out a back room, or I'll do something to make the life easier. But then you have also a solid core of people who just, you know, I've got my house. Why should you be living on the street outside my back gate and making it feel dangerous for my child to walk to school, or, you know, being a visual blight on the landscape? I think you're going to see a very divided public opinion on this.
Now, when we saw this story, when we wanted to talk to the Department of Sanitation about it, we had an interview all scheduled and ready to go at the last second. I mean, we were right there to do the interview, and they backed out. They prefer to let the mayor speak first before we get to speak to them maybe later this week. How's it been for you, Sharon, reporting on this?
Oh, I'm so astonished. that the head of sanitation would not come on ahead of the mayor. Okay, so I started reporting on this story when the homeless count came out about 2 weeks ago, and I called the Bureau of Sanitation and said, please tell me what you're doing about trash in homeless encampments. They deferred to the mayor's office, and then it took 2 weeks to get an interview in person with the mayor's czar of homeless services. And she told me Thursday, the day before this plan came out, if we could roll out something like garbage cans for all the encampments in a day, we would. But that would take a massive shift in thinking. And then the very next day, Bureau of Sanitation comes out with this extensive plan. So, I mean, I don't know if the two sides are not talking to each other or if they're not talking to the public, if they're not talking to reporters. But the communication issues at this city hall are nuts.
Frustrating. KPCC's infrastructure reporter, Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Now to another health matter. Reports of elder abuse are on the rise in L.A. and Orange counties. Now, most of those cases involve people scamming seniors out of their money or outright stealing it from them. But as KPCC's Michelle Faust-Ragovan reports, financial abuse hurts more than a person's pocketbook.
Bob is a sharp, active 88-year-old from San Clemente. He laughs at the length scammers have gone to try to fool him, like the time he got a letter from the head of the FBI saying he was owed money.
To think that the head of the FBI would write a letter, a personal letter to me telling me about that just was absurd.
Bob is healthy, social, and educated. He's not the kind of guy you'd expect to fall for fraud. But about a year ago, while he was mourning the loss of his wife,
I was a victim of a scam.
Bob asked that we only use his first name because he's embarrassed. He got a call from a man who claimed to work for a computer support service he subscribed to. The man told Bob he was owed a refund. He convinced Bob to give him online access to his bank accounts. Suddenly, the man was in a panic, saying he'd mistakenly deposited $20,000 in Bob's checking account.
They're great actors, these scam artists, and he was crying and moaning about how he was going to lose his job.
Bob says there was an extra $20,000 in his checking account, so he wrote two checks to the scammer for $10,000 each.
I thought everything was square and I was okay until I found that there was $20,000 missing from my savings account.
Bob was lucky. He's gotten most of his money back, but the con took a heavy toll on him. He recently wrote about it to Kelly Morris, the director of the Orange County Senior Protection Program. She reads from his email.
My unfortunate experience in late April of 2018 has left me with a number of physical and psychological impairments.
Bob wrote that the episode hurt his self-confidence.
My independence and self-sufficiency have been hammered. I no longer trust people as before.
Bob tells me the worst of it is that it's hard to get a good night's sleep.
I wake up in some kind of a nightmare where somebody's trying to take advantage of me, you know, and it's part, again, of that ruptured trust, and I'm just trying to get over that.
Kelly Morris says what happened to Bob is typical, that for many seniors, losing money is the least problematic part of being a victim of a financial scam.
What the people are surprised by is all of these things that happen to their both emotional and physical health once they become victimized.
Researchers found that elder abuse of all types, including financial abuse, increases hospitalization rates and the risk of death. The people responsible for taking financial advantage of seniors are often friends or relatives. Older people are most vulnerable if they're suffering from underlying health problems, like a cognitive impairment. Dr. Bonnie Olson is a clinical psychologist at USC's Keck School of Medicine. She says financial abuse is often just part of the story.
When we see one type of abuse, we really do look for others because it often comes in combinations. They may also mistreat them emotionally, so berate them or make them feel guilty or even threaten them.
This can really disrupt relationships with friends and family.
One of the first things we see that happens is that someone who's been mistreated pulls away.
That's not the case for Bob. He says getting scammed motivated him to pull closer to the people in his life.
I meet regularly with the friends from work, retirees, and with the church groups and others. And I haven't removed myself from any of those sources of aid.
And that might just be what Bob needs to recover from the blow of financial abuse. Covering health, I'm Michelle Faust-Dragovan.
This reporting was supported by the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. Joining me now to dig deeper into the problem of elder financial abuse is our very own Michelle Faust-Ragovan. Michelle, that's one of my future worries. I gotta admit, I'm worried that if I'm all alone, something like that might happen to me. So, and I know there was a lot of information that you weren't able to fit in. So what else did you learn in your reporting?
Well, when we looked at the Elder Protective Services data from 2006 to 2018, statewide, there were more cases of elder financial abuse last year than ever before. And they mostly look at cases of abuse in the home. So financial abuse is most common. It's the most common type of abuse. And usually it comes with other types of abuse, as we mentioned in the story. In LA, Riverside, Ventura counties, the number of confirmed elder financial abuse cases more than doubled over that time period. In San Bernardino County, they nearly doubled. And in Orange County, cases quadrupled, more than quadrupled, actually. And national experts estimate that this is just the tip of the iceberg. Most elder abuse is going unreported.
Doubled, quadrupled. It could be worse. I mean, that's some huge growth. Why is this happening?
Well, one of the things is we have more older adults. So seniors are the most quickly, the population segment that's growing the quickest. Also, there are more reports to Adult Protective Services. That is actually a good thing. That means that people are more aware of it and they are going to get help. So that could be potentially a good thing. Also, part of this is just elders are where a lot of the wealth is. 85% of the nation's wealth is held by seniors. Wow. 85%. So that's a lot of where the money is. It's also a crime of opportunity. When you have elders who have health issues or if they have dementia, they're much more likely to be a target. And people can get carried away if they're caregiving for someone. So if a family member has access to bank accounts, sometimes they start with maybe semi-good intentions. They're thinking they're going to pay money back. Things happen. They lose track and they don't. And then some people just feel entitled to other people's money.
Now, your story talked about how the stress of getting scammed out of their money is toxic for many older adults' health. Why is that?
Well, one of those things is that you build your savings over a lifetime to retire. When you're retired, it is very hard to go back and reaccumulate that wealth. So that is very stressful. Also, think about the high cost of healthcare. Think about how much some of your premiums and some of your copays can be. Now, imagine if you have a lot of health issues and you're older. That can take a toll. You might cut back on going to the doctor. You might cut back on some of your pills. In the worst cases, people cutting back on food. That can be a problem. And a lot of things are happening related to shame. Fortunately, Bob seems to be recovering well because he's got a support network. But other adults have told me that being scammed ruined their relationships with their family members because they question, how could you do that? Yeah. It's ruined their faith in law enforcement. It's made them hard for them to feel safe anywhere. That has a huge toll on your physical and mental health.
Michelle, please tell us there are things people can do to protect themselves from getting ripped off.
Well, the best thing you can do to support the people in your life, there are two things. Keep strong relationships with the older adults in your life and be aware and learn how to detect elder financial abuse. So know about the scams that are targeting elders. Calls pretending to be a grandchild in trouble, for example. People pretending to have lottery winnings. You just need to give a little money and you'll get it back. And then there's things like Medicare fraud.
I talk to my uncle every day. I call him out right after work. He's 70 years old. That's part of it, right? Talking to older folks that are
right.
in your life.
That's right. So you want to talk about it. You want to talk about the scams. You want to talk about elder abuse, and not just to the seniors in your life, to everyone, because it really is important that everyone understand that this is an issue. Also, some basic financial literacy can be helpful in some cases. Know the red flags, usually unusual activity on bank accounts, suddenly not being able to afford things as they used to, and signs of depression. You can also get help from the financial abuse specialist team that's called the FAST team, the police, or Adult Protective Services.
That's KPCC health reporter Michelle Faust-Ragovan with more of her ongoing coverage of seniors' health. Michelle's reporting on elder abuse is supported by the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism, and you can see Michelle in action tonight. tonight, starting at 7 p.m., there's a live conversation about universal health care at the Japanese American National Museum. For more information, go to kpcc.org/in-person. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Historically, Hollywood has had an at best spotty record when it comes to inclusion in casting. For example, Westerns, when Native Americans were played by white actors. Well, in the past few years, Hollywood has been called to the carpet on this. Coming up, a major television network commits to fostering casting inclusivity for a specific group of performers. Find out who when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Podcasts supported by Spectrum News One, where talk meets action, where politicians meet constituents, where issues meet understanding. Join host Alex Cohen for Inside the Issues on Spectrum News One, a nightly political show that takes you inside the issues affecting you, your family, and your community. Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The death of Italian director Franco Zeffirelli reignites allegations of abuse. Plus, one of Hollywood's favorite watering holes is reopening. Let's go on the lot.
God, is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan joins us now, as she does every Wednesday. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
Hi. Now, okay, now let's start first with the news of Italian director Franco Zeffirelli. He passed away over the weekend. What films was he known for?
Well, Zeffirelli was kind of a maximalist in various art forms. He directed these lavish operas and theater productions. In film, specifically, he was known for his adaptations of Shakespeare. He was nominated for an Oscar for the 1968 version of Romeo and Juliet. He directed the Liz Taylor, Richard Burton Taming of the Shrew, and Mel Gibson's Hamlet.
All right, so how has Zeffirelli's death shed a light on his darker side?
Well, multiple men have alleged that he sexually assaulted them when they were young actors. I spoke to two of them this week who described a fairly similar pattern where he would be sort of very flattering, kind of grooming them. Then they would have an aggressive, unwanted advance. And then he would start berating and belittling the men and their acting ability.
And you spoke with Jonathan Scheck mostly about his experience with Zeffirelli. He was one of the few men to come out with his story during the hashtag MeToo movement. How is Jonathan Scheck dealing with Zeffirelli's death?
Well, he said he's forgiven Zeffirelli. One thing that both of the men told me, another man who I spoke to is a pastor on Long Island who had not previously gone public with his experience with Zeffirelli. One thing they both said was that it's been painful to watch Franco Zeffirelli celebrated. Most of the obituaries about him did not mention any allegations of abuse.
It's been almost 3 years since Me Too. How has Scheck's activism continued?
Well, he was sort of late in the movement. It was after women began to speak about Harvey Weinstein that he first spoke publicly in January of 2018. But he's stayed engaged, and he is one of only a handful of men who are sort of at the forefront of it. He's done a public service announcement for RAIN, the Rape and Sexual Abuse Survivors Network. He's also working with SAG-AFTRA on its caucuses about sexual misconduct in the industry. One thing he told me that was interesting is that he hasn't booked new work since speaking out in January of 2018. So he feels, on the one hand, relief that he went public, but also he wants to work.
One of the things, though, in the story that that you wrote is he mentions how this whole thing dented his confidence in a lot of ways. And we've heard that from other performers where, you know, you always hear maybe, okay, well, you get through it and you figure it out and you move your career forward. But sometimes it's really, really difficult to keep moving forward when you have this weighing on you.
Yeah, it's interesting. Jonathan Cheick was on a Vanity Fair cover in the early 90s, right after this incident happened. And the other actors on it are Leonardo DiCaprio and Matthew McConaughey and Will Smith. And Jonathan Cheick, who most, I think it's safe to say most people had not heard of prior to him coming out about Me Too. So it does seem to have hit his career at a particular moment and had a damaging effect.
All right. Staying with activism, let's move on now to CBS Studio and the new commitment it's just taken on. What can you tell us about what they're doing?
My colleague Rebecca Sun reported that CBS is the first company that's committed to auditioning actors with disabilities for each new production going forward. So at CBS, they'll be doing it for any project that gets a series pickup.
All right. So what sparked this pledge of theirs?
CBS was pushed by the Ruderman Family Foundation, which has pointed out that about 20% of Americans have a disability, but fewer than 2% of TV characters do. Of those characters, 95% are being played by able-bodied actors.
Now, diversity and inclusion have been big topics in Hollywood in recent years. So where does disability inclusion fall within that?
What's interesting, disability hasn't gotten as much attention as issues of race and gender and sexuality, but it does seem like that's starting to change and people are starting to talk about it. It's also interesting because many actors have gotten a lot of praise for playing disabled characters or characters with disabilities, but there has not been a real move for actors who actually have disabilities. So it'll be interesting to see if this evolves to be an issue in the months ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if we can expect other studios to follow CBS's lead. I always thought, Rebecca, in this day and age, there's almost no excuse not to get as many people as possible to audition for something, especially when so many people are dying to represent whatever it is or whoever it is they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why this initiative may take hold is because, as you say, you're committing to audition people. So it's not a commitment to cast, which is what sort of the inclusion rider is. It's saying you're going to expand the circle of people who you're considering for work. It's very difficult for studios to explain why they couldn't do that.
All right, let's move on now to news about one of Hollywood's favorite watering holes, the Formosa Cafe.
Yeah, I'm right outside.
Yes, we stop worrying. How many rich, young, eccentric, pathetic Texans can be in the Formosa on a Tuesday afternoon?
That's from Still Breathing, the romantic comedy starring Brendan Fraser. It's one of a handful of films that features the Formosa. Remind us, Rebecca, why was the cafe shut down in the first place?
Well, if you don't know what the Formosa is, you've probably driven by it. It's that pink restaurant on Santa Monica Boulevard, just west of La Brea, very busy corner, which recent years had a mall with a Target and a Jersey Mike's built in. For a restaurant that had first opened in 1939, the construction and the changing times have not been kind. There was a botched renovation in 2015 that stripped out a lot of the authentic charm, and then it was scheduled to be demolished twice before being saved by historic preservationists.
Yeah, and you've seen a film in L.A. Confidential, in the movie Swingers. It's been closed for 2 years. What's the renovation process been like?
Well, expensive for one thing. They spent about $2.4 million gutting it down to the studs. Got the red vinyl booths are back. You can sit at Lana Turner's booth or John Wayne's or Elvis Presley's. I'm personally going to stake out Ava Gardner's. You know, pick out who you like.
Your colleague Leslie Bella actually got a preview for The Hollywood Reporter. What details has she shared about the cafe and its restoration?
Well, one thing that's interesting is they really put an emphasis on sourcing materials from places with a Hollywood connection. So there are these like pagoda style roof tiles, which came from Warner Brothers scenery department. Also these terrazzo floor tiles, which are kind of like the ones that line the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So even when they're using new materials, they're trying to get them from sort of classic Hollywood sources.
And put this into context for us. So why is the Formosa Cafe so iconic in the first place?
Well, it was really, as you say, it was a watering hole for much of classic Hollywood because of its location. It was next to what was the original United Artists lot. It's sort of close to Paramount. You'd see Humphrey Bogart and John Wayne and really all of Hollywood stopping by for a drink.
We'd always hear about deals being made there, movies getting thought up. Everything
right.
Possible in the entertainment biz has been discussed at the Formosa Cafe in some way.
Yeah, supposedly the movie Ed Wood was written there, that Tim Burton and Johnny Depp had sort of crucial planning meetings there. It's interesting because the people who are remaking it are the people who renovated a bar called the Idle Hour, which is one of my favorite bars in North Hollywood. It's shaped like a giant barrel on Lancashire Boulevard. They do a great job with this Hollywood history stuff, so I'm crossing my fingers.
All right, one more thing. Let's talk about Netflix's big premiere over the weekend, Murder Mystery.
Charles is inviting us to spend the weekend with him on a yacht.
Crushing the party with civilians.
There's been a murder!
Should we pull it out?
No, it's a foot-long knife.
Will you listen to my husband? He's a detective.
I'll put it back. Don't put it back.
It stars Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. And according to Netflix, it did very well. How well, Rebecca?
Well, Netflix says that 30.9 million accounts streamed this movie over 3 days. And Netflix considers it a full stream of the movie if you watch at least 70% of it. So they're giving you a sense of that. They say about 13 million of those accounts were in North America and about 17 million of them were international. They're calling it their quote unquote biggest opening weekend ever. It's interesting because Netflix has not necessarily described a movie as a by its quote unquote opening weekend. That's a term the rest of Hollywood likes to use. They're starting to now use that language.
So why? Why is Netflix doing that? I mean, they've always been very secretive about their viewing data. I'd love to know more about some of the stuff they put out there, but why are they sharing so much now?
Well, they're sharing their hits. You'll notice they're not putting out press releases to say nobody watched this movie that we spent a lot of money on. What we've heard from some talent agents is that the talent involved want to win. So Adam Sandler was once known as the box office king. If he really had a big opening weekend, he may want people to know about it. I'm not saying in this specific case it was Adam Sandler driving it, but in Hollywood, people like to quantify their successes and be able to share them for the next deal that they want to cut or simply for sort of ego needs. So this is serving that to a certain extent.
Never underestimate the power of someone's ego.
Never.
Not in Hollywood, especially. Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins me every Wednesday to talk about the entertainment biz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, I live right down the street from the Burbank Airport. It's been 20 years for me in that house, so by now I'm used to the rumbling of all the jet engines that fly over. It's kind of just become one of the sounds of living in Burbank. But for some folks who live a little further away, planes buzzing their rooftops on departure was not what they signed up for. Coming up, why members of Congress are being sucked into the debate over jet sounds. Find out why when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Nobody likes a noisy neighbor, and it doesn't get much noisier than a jet engine. The Hollywood Burbank Airport has been a source of frustration for those living in the area because of the flights over people's homes. And in recent years, residents say they've noticed a change in the flight's path in and out of the airport, making noise a problem for new areas. Now, the airport authority and local congressmen are calling on the Federal Aviation Administration to take action. Anthony Carpio-Clark has been following this for the Burbank Leader. He joins us now from the paper's newsroom. Anthony, thanks for coming on Take Two.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. So for Burbank residents, airport noise is nothing new, but there have been complaints now from Studio City. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a 2-year struggle for these residents. Back at around March 2017, the FAA started implementing their next-gen system, this satellite-based system that's trying to make flights more efficient, but it seems to be pushing these departing flights from Hollywood Burbank towards Studio City and Sherman Oaks and for other cities in the South San Fernando Valley.
Now, we're going to get to next gen coming up in just a few seconds. What have residents, though, Anthony, told you about all the noise issues?
It's pretty much ruining their lives. A lot of folks are very, very distraught about what's been happening over the last couple of years, just people losing sleep, not being able to enjoy their backyards and patios just because the noise, and especially for folks that live up in the canyon areas, the noise just reverberates in that area, and it's unbearable for many for many folks out there.
We're talking to Anthony Carpio-Clark. He's been following this story on the Burbank Airport for the Burbank Leader. Now, you mentioned next-gen flight paths. First off, what is next-gen, this new technology that the FAA is using?
So it's a satellite-based guiding system that the FAA has been rolling out since 2007, but more recently in Southern California since March of 2017. And again, it's trying to make these flights in and out of these airports just more fuel efficient, safer, and time efficient. They just want to get these planes up and out and where they need to go just more efficiently. But it seems like it's causing more of a nuisance than it is a benefit for travelers.
How is that? How is next gen connected possibly to the noise complaints?
Well, there was a report out in October by firm Landrum and Brown that cited that indeed NextGen has something to do with these flights now flying over Studio City, but they couldn't definitively pinpoint these noise concerns, these lower flight altitudes with this new system.
So is there any actual evidence, or is it all just anecdotal?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, there's evidence from that Landrum and Brown report that does document more flights in the Studio City area, more so over the past 2 years than previously. But the anecdotal evidence is pretty strong too.
Well, I'll offer some anecdotal evidence because I live right there. There's this walking track that's right by a fire station in Burbank that I'll admit, I mean, since I've been walking there, I've seen more planes go over that particular area and kind of curve around the Sherman Oaks Studio City area. So I've noticed a difference in the last couple of years. What has the Hollywood Burbank Airport said about these noise complaints?
At first they were saying that it wasn't due to NextGen. They were pinning it on just the improving economy. And you mean more seats and more people in these seats mean heavier planes. So they were just anticipating these lower takeoffs. But as time went on, it was really evident that these flights were moving because of something. The airport officials really haven't pinpointed what the exact cause of these flight path shifts why they started to move.
Now, there have been a couple of moves this week to find solutions for the noise problem. What's being done?
Yeah, so airport officials just passed a resolution on Monday, essentially asking the FAA to change their departing flight paths from the airport. I mean, it's an ask. Not a lot can be done on the airport's part. All they can really do is ask the federal agency to move their flight path so it isn't bugging these residents. But also on Tuesday, Congressman Adam Schiff and Brad Sherman, along with 27 other members of Congress, they just sent a letter to the Government Accountability Office, and they're trying to pin down what the exact cause of these issues are nationwide and what the FAA is doing to mitigate all these noise concerns.
So just to be clear, Anthony, it would be in the hands of the FAA to make changes. Any changes at all have to come from them.
And that's what a lot of airport officials have been saying, and they've been pretty blunt about saying that the FAA is in charge of what happens when these planes are up in the air.
One more thing, Anthony. So let's just say something happens and they do change the flight plan or the flight pattern. What's there to stop some other group of residents to complain about the new noise by the changed flight pattern?
I mean, that's to be seen. I mean, obviously, Burbank has been the city that's been fighting the airport with aircraft noise for decades, and now it's shifted over to Studio City. So, yeah, we don't know. We don't know if North Hollywood folks will complain if it moves towards them, or if other neighborhoods in the San Fernando Valley will start complaining if it moves in their area. So it really is up in the air.
There you go. Up in the air. Anthony Carpio-Clark is a reporter for the Burbank Leader. Anthony, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Now, one more thing before we go. The long-awaited Alamo Draft House is scheduled to open in downtown L.A. next month. The 12-screen theater will be located in the Block Shopping Mall at 7th and Flower Streets. In the works for 5 years, the Alamo Draft House theaters will be able to screen 35mm films in addition to screening movies with 4K digital projectors. And, of course, there will be a lot of food. Alamo may have gotten its start in Austin, Texas, but its L.A. location will serve locally inspired options and have a full bar and kitchen. Now, the exact opening date hasn't been announced quite yet, but expect a soft opening in early July. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. If you missed any part of the show, just find our podcast, the Take Two Podcast, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.